This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I'm filling in this week for Al Reynolds, and we're reading from the Triangle Business Journal, dated September 14th, 2012. New player rolling dice on Crabtree site. Two Houston real estate companies are rethinking the game plan for the former Kids Hill Plaza property that overlooks Crabtree Valley Mall, and it involves hundreds of luxury apartment units. Houston-based apartment developer Martin J. Fine Interests has filed plans with the city to build 336 multifamily units at Crabtree Place on the Crabtree Valley Avenue. If approved, it would be the fourth large multifamily project proposed within a quarter mile of the mall in the past year. That brings the total to nearly 1,800 new units planned in the vicinity, with a total combined value of more than $200 million. The Fine Interest project is slated for a 12-acre site that retail developer Weingarten Realty Investors of Houston purchased in 2007. Weingarten intended to build a mixed-use project with entertainment venues, restaurants, shops, office buildings, and housing. Weingarten shelved that plan when the economy went south. High-end apartments have always been in the mix for Crabtree Place, but the Fine Interest plan shows that apartments would cover nearly 60% of the site. That would leave 5 acres at the corner of Creedmoor Road and Crabtree Valley Avenue for other uses such as retail and restaurants. Daniel Fine, assistant vice president at Fine Interest, would not disclose specifics about the Crabtree apartment projects, such as projected rental states or construction cost estimates. But he noted that Fine has been looking for potential development sites in Raleigh since 2008. "We try to position ourselves in markets with great multifamily fundamentals, and Raleigh is a great city," he says. All of Fine's garden apartment projects to date have been in urban areas of Texas, Arizona, and Colorado. The Crabtree Place community would be the company's first in North Carolina. Fine's most recent development opened in 2011. The Verona at the Reserve Apartment Community in Katy, Texas, has 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units with rental rates between $965 and $2,200 a month. Weingarten's recent director, Bill Coates, for regional affairs, said he couldn't comment about Fine's plans in Raleigh. Apartment builders from across the county have been flocking to the Triangle over the past couple of years, hoping to grab a piece of market share while apartment demand is still growing. The region's apartment vacancy rate has been on a steady decline, reaching a low of 6% in July, according to the apartment market analyst firm of Real Data of Charlotte. The market's average monthly rental rate has increased by 15% since January of 2010. Multifamily Realty Advisors, a Raleigh brokerage and investment advisory firm, estimates that nearly 12,000 new apartment units are currently under construction in the Triangle region or will be under construction before the end of the year. By comparison, only 1,300 new apartment units were completed in all of 2011. "We've gone from one extreme to the other," says Richard Cotton, managing director of Multifamily Realty Advisors. "About a year ago, I wrote an article that hinted that we could conceivably see an overbuilt situation, and a lot of people criticized me for that because they said that most of those projects were not going to be financed or get built. But guess what? They are getting built," Cotton said. Cotton notes, though, that most of the new construction in the Triangle is not concentrated in one area, and that demand is strong for apartments in downtown Raleigh, central Durham, and the Crabtree Valley area. Other apartment projects planned near Crabtree Valley Mall include the 384-unit Marshall Park on the Greenway on Blue Ridge Road, the 525-unit Crabtree Valley project on Homewood Banks Drive, and the 533-unit Crabtree North on Leadvine Road. The submarket that Cotton is watching closely is around the Briar Creek area in West Raleigh, which 5 years ago went through a period of adjustment when too many apartments opened around the same time. All of those units have now been absorbed, but there are six projects that started around the same time, and history is about to repeat itself, he says. The next article. Airlines, hotels coming back from recession. Business travel is returning to pre-recession levels, even as recovery in most other type of economic activity continues to lag. Companies cut their travel spending sharply in late 2008 and only began to bring it back in 2010. And now, 2 years later, it's on the verge of a full recovery by some measures. Passenger numbers at Raleigh-Durham International Airport have edged upward for more than 2 years and have continued to do so in the last 12 months as airlines begin to raise fares again. The impact is being felt at Triangle Hotels, which took in $474 million in 2011, roughly equaling their 2007 revenue. Hotels are on track to top $500 million in 2012. Several local hotels have changed hands since last year, too, with buyers planning to pour millions of dollars into renovations. Occupancy ran at 66.5% in the first 7 months of the year at 15 top-end hotels in the Triangle, higher than any January to July period since 2008, this according to Smith Travel Research. While business people stay at a wide range of hotels, luxury hotels are a particular bellwether for business travel because they offer extensive amenities such as ballrooms for meetings and conferences. Business travel has resumed its upward trajectory, says Martin Bates, Vice President of Research for Global Business Travel Association. Travel on corporate accounts began to pick up strongly just this spring at Cambria Suites, says Yogesh Mananoka, whose Carolina Hotels and Resorts LLC owns. Midweek occupancy at the hotel off Airport Boulevard in Mooresville is mostly in the high 80s, up from the 70s a couple of years ago, allowing the hotel to raise weekend rates by $6 to $8. Investments and tax revenue. The rebounding market has helped to spur investment. A developer recently proposed a 125-room hotel at Southern Village in Chapel Hill. The Hilton Raleigh-Durham Airport is in the middle of a $7.5 million renovation. Sound Hospitality Management plans to spend $2.5 million renovating the Clarion Hotel State Capitol on Hillsborough Street in downtown Raleigh. The Miami-based company bought the inn in late August of 2009 for $9.35 million with an eye on growing business and government-related travel, supported in part by software company Red Hat's move downtown. Sound Hospitality is also converting the hotel back to its original Holiday Inn brand. Wake County Hotels generated $16.2 million in occupancy tax revenue in the fiscal year that ended in June, this according to the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau. The $14.9 million generated in the 2010-2011 year was roughly equal to a pre-recession high, and the new figure represents growth of about 9% beyond that. The rebound has also brought job growth. Hotels and motels in the Research Triangle Regional Partnership, a 13-county economic development zone, employed about 8,200 people in the first 3 months of 2012, up from 7,900 in the first 3 months of 2010. Managers at several high-end hotels say their leisure business has remained middling. Weekend occupancy has actually fallen slightly at the Sheraton Imperial Hotel near Research Triangle Park, Director of Sales Teresa Palmieri says. Like Manocho, Palmieri says weeknight business has bounced back robustly in the last year, both among corporate groups and individual business travelers. Looking for economies? For all that, business travel is returning with a newfound sense of frugality. Palmieri says many RTB companies are hosting modestly sized meetings at their own sites while using the hotel's facilities for only the largest events. Bates at the Travel Association says companies that used to fly their employees to business class switched to economy class during the recession. Many are now shifting up only to Economy Plus, Economy Comfort, and other intermediate classes of seating that airlines have been introducing in the last year. People in the industry say business travel is difficult to qualify precisely, and evidence of a rebound, while strong, is largely anecdotal. For one thing, airports and airline passenger statistics don't distinguish between business and leisure travelers. The 4.58 million passengers who boarded at RDU in 2011 represented growth of about 1% from 2010, but the airport itself doesn't know exactly how much of the growth came from business travel. That's also true of the 0.5% growth in the first 7 months of 2012. In terms of cold cash, however, the recovery is fairly clear. Bates Group estimates that U.S. companies will spend $257 billion on business travel in 2012, just shy of $260 billion of pre-recession high, and up 2.2% from 2011. The next article is entitled, 1,200 Jobs at Stake. Threatened in bankruptcy, Kerry Center is still in jeopardy. And American Airlines and U.S. Airways executives continue to talk about merging the carriers. A big winner or loser in the final decision could be Kerry, where 1,200 people work in an AA reservation center. What's little known is that the Kerry Center narrowly missed the chopping block after the American parent company, AMR Corp., filed for bankruptcy. After going over the numbers, AMR executives decided to keep Kerry running and instead shut down a reservation center in Tucson with 700 workers. "I don't think people around here realize how close we were from losing 1,200 jobs," says Frank Baird, a principal with the Capital Associates in Kerry, which owns the Gregson Drive building that American Airlines occupies. Even though the Kerry Center now provides a little more than half the 2,100 people it employed soon after it opened, those jobs are important to the Raleigh-Kerry Center, which had a 7.9% unemployment rate in July. Losing them also would represent another bout of erosion in terms of American presence in the market. That presence began in a big way in 1985, when American announced it would open a major hub at Raleigh-Durham International Airport. The hub and reservation centers both opened in 1988. Combined, they employed nearly 5,000. As airport director at the time, John Brantley was involved in negotiating the deal. This, he said, "This was a big deal for the business community and for North Carolina back then. At one time, RDU was one of the smallest airports in the U.S. with a major airline hub. The fact that American Airlines picked this area for a hub brought a lot of knowledge of presence to this area." While it's been nearly 18 years since the hub was shuttered and replaced in 2008 by RDU's Gleaming Terminal 2 building, the Kerry Reservation Call Center has survived. How long it can do so is a big question, given the rise of online sites for booking travel and continuing competition from travel agencies. But the biggest threat to the survival of the Kerry Center could lie in those merger talks involving American and U.S. Airways. U.S. Airways has a hub at the Charlotte Airport and its own reservation call center in Winston-Salem with about 900 employees. Kerry could have an edge in the fact that American's reservation center is not unionized. U.S. Airways, more than 6,000 customer service employees and reservations agents nationwide, are represented by the Communication Workers of America and the International Brotherhood of Teamsters Union Organizations. While no one with the airlines is ready to answer specifics about the future, American Airlines spokesman Matt Miller says the company continues to create jobs in Kerry. "Our headcount is actually increasing," he says, saying, "Four new hire classes are currently in training at Kerry, with additional classes scheduled to the end of the year. Not all those new hires will be clocking in at the Kerry Reservation Center, though. About 40% of the center's workforce, including about 200 call center workers who live in other states, are now home-based employees who report to work virtually," says Miller. "The other 60% work in shifts at the Kerry building." According to an online job posting, a reservation center job candidate for American Airlines must live within a 75-mile radius of the reservation's office and attend a 6-week training class. The starting pay, salary, is $9.53 an hour, and at-home office representatives can earn up to $15 an hour. Next article, Saving Spurred BCBSNC's Stake. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina sees sound reasons for investing in FastMed Urgent Care that manages clinics. Ultimately, company officials say, the urgent care clinics can save the insurance money. Visits made to hospital emergency rooms by patients who are not experiencing a true emergency. They present with snivels, tummy aches, minor cuts, and the like. They make up nearly 14% of all ER claims. Even a 5% shift from ER use to a less costly urgent care clinic could reduce medical spending by $8 million annually. That's not an insignificant amount for the company, which paid out $167 million in ER claims for visit that did not result in an admission in 2011. We need solutions that provide the right care at the right time and in the right setting to build a more efficient healthcare system, says Brad Wilson, BABNC's president and CEO. That's the thinking behind the investment in West Palm Beach, Florida-based the ComFest Group, which manages FastMed, a company owned by physicians and headquartered in Clayton. The infusion injects cash to accelerate the opening of more clinics in North Carolina. The amount and terms were undisclosed. Thousands of patients treated in hospital ERs would be better served in a less emergency scenario. If urgent care clinics served that population, it would cut down on overall health care costs, not only for third-party payers like health insurers, but also for patients and hospitals. The cost of an emergency room visit averages $1,500. By contrast, the average cost of an urgent care clinic is just $142. Any emergency room visit that could have been treated in an urgent care clinic can result in an overall savings of more than 90%, including for the out-of-pocket expenses of a patient. So, the stakes are big. ComFest has $1.2 billion in assets under management. In 2011, BCBSNC wrote $5 billion in direct premiums. Between the parent insurer and the sub-entities, it generated $201 million in net income that year. Not everyone sees only positives in the relationship. Adam Searing with the Health Access Coalition of the North Carolina Justice Center points out a potential conflict of interest when a payer, the insurance company, also has a financial stake in the provider, the clinics. How do we measure whether people are getting appropriate care, he posed. I don't think you can just assume that. In response, BCBSNC says the clinics will remain physician-owned, with BCBSNC investing only in the management side of the business, that being through the ComFest Group. Each clinic is accredited by the Urgent Care Association of America and has set the bar on quality measures in North Carolina. Urgent care centers are multiplying under various brand names, and hospitals generally are supportive of them because they relieve overcrowding in emergency departments, which are nearly always stretched thin. In fact, hospitals are opening standalone clinics as well. We spend a lot of time treating conditions that could be treated elsewhere, says Steve Burris, chief operating officer of the Rex Healthcare, the Raleigh hospital owned by UNC Healthcare. Healthcare economist and Duke University professor Peter Ubel agrees. Urgent care is much more cost-effective, he says. Rex operates 4 clinics under the Rex Express Care name and plans to open a 5th. By the end of the year, there will be 29 FastMed urgent care centers in North Carolina, including 11 in the Triangle. FastMed has contracts with major insurance providers. The next article, Inclusive Jobless Data Land NC 4th in Nation. Though beginning to show slow improvement, North Carolina's latest comprehensive unemployment rate of 17.5% makes it the fourth hardest hit in the country. That's North Carolina's so-called U6 rate, which factors in the official jobless number in addition to part-time workers who would rather be working full-time and discouraged workers not included in the announced monthly unemployment tallies. North Carolina's official unemployment rates were 9.4% in June and 9.6% in July. Technically, U6 is a measure of the extent to which the state's labor force remains idle, explains UNC Chapel Hill researcher Daniel Gitterman in a new report on the state's recovery from the Great Recession. A better name for the U6 would be underemployment rate. Before the downturn in 2008, North Carolina's U6 reading was 11.3%. By 2011, it had hit 17.9%. The most recent figure of 17.5% came at the end of the second quarter of 2012, this according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Though falling from the 2011 level, the state's second quarter U6 put it in fourth place, nationally behind Nevada, 22%, California, 20.3%, and Rhode Island, 18.9%. Rhode Island, says the BLS, was the only state in the union with a higher U6 number in mid-2012 than at the close of 2011. As the recovery continues to catch on in the state, both the U6 and the official unemployment rates will be affected. For instance, if employers more optimistic about the future begin converting more part-time jobs into full-time, expect a drop in the U6, which counts part-time workers, says labor market analyst John Quinterno. Meanwhile, if more jobless and discouraged residents renew their job hunt, the U6 would fall, but the official rate, which doesn't count the discouraged, would rise. North Carolina's economy needs to add 6,000 jobs per month, 72,000 a year, just to keep up with new people entering the market. Add that to the number of jobs lost in the state between 2007 and 2012, and North Carolina's so-called jobs gap now stands at about 540,000, according to Gitterman's report. While government payrolls remain flat or continue to shrink, the state's private sector added 41,500 jobs in 2011 and 22,700 in the first 6 months of 2012. UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton in June estimated that North Carolina establishments could add up to 40,800 more jobs by the year's end. Now, from the Spotlight Technology section, North Carolina State University at core of $18.5 million sensor work. The device might be a cap on your tooth or a band on your wrist. Whatever it is, researchers promise the wearer won't notice it's there. What are these sensor devices that can check a range of body functions, including vitals such as heart rate and oxygen levels? And, as a bonus, they are powered by energy harvested from the body wearing them. You never have to change a battery, says John Muth, an engineering professor and deputy program director at the Center for Advanced Self-Power Systems of Integrated Sensors and Technology, this at North Carolina State University. Now, that's a long name, so just call it ASSIST, which is getting $18.5 million over 5 years from the National Sciences Foundation. The program is headquartered on North Carolina State's Centennial Campus and is a joint effort between North Carolina State and Florida International University, Pennsylvania State University, and the University of Virginia also are involved. David Pettin, Project Medical Director and Senior Associate Dean for Transitional Research at the UNC School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, says the devices are being designed to communicate in real time, possibly sending signals about a person's health or environment to his or her own smartphone. We're hoping this will be a springboard to answer a variety of health questions, he says. but it's not the technology that makes the Collaborative project potentially groundbreaking. It's also the business model. More than 30 industry partners have representatives participating in the program, and the team is looking for additional companies. Industry partners are more than just a funding source. They're ultimately a way to get the technology into the marketplace. Maybe one day one of these industry partners can license the technology, Mahmood says. Energy harvesting is one important element to what our company already does, says Anthony Atti, CEO of Durham-based thermoelectric company Phonic Devices. While he and other industry professionals will assist the project by providing feedback, they'll get research in return. I would like to see technical innovation linked with real applicable market upon which companies like ours can come in and complete the commercialization. Other companies involved include Raleigh sensor startup Valentella, San Diego-based mobile technology company Qualcomm, and Schomburg, Illinois-based Motorola. Member companies contribute $30,000 each to have access to research data. Vina Misra, ESSIS director and an engineering professor at North Carolina State, says that while the initial focus is on finding uses for sensors in healthcare, many companies expressing interest have Department of Defense contracts, and she sees military applications. Louis Martin Vega, dean of the College of Engineering at NC State, says a project is a tremendous feather in the university's cap, making it the only college of engineering in the nation with two active NSF research centers. The other, Freedom, is a center whose focus is on distribution and management of renewable energy. It was established at North Carolina State in 2008 and had its funding renewed through 2016. Freedom has had 49 industrial partners and, combined with ASSIST, pushes the reputation of everything to another level. Part of our goal is to encourage more students and a diverse pool of students to consider engineering as a career. Like ASSIST, Freedom is funded by an $18.5 million five-year NSF grant with the potential of being renewed. The current timeline includes having a prototype in year two. The next article is entitled, North Carolina Feds Cracking Down on Overcharging by Contractors. The United States and North Carolina governments have dramatically stepped up their actions against contractors suspected of overcharging in the last couple of years, leading to millions of dollars in court settlements for some companies and increased compliant costs for numerous others. The new wave of enforcement comes largely in the form of civil suits filed under the North Carolina False Claims Act, which went into effect in January 2010, and a parallel federal statute. The federal law was enacted in 1863, but is being used with growing frequency by the Justice Department under President Barack Obama. The U.S. Department of Justice says it has announced recoveries averaging nearly $4 billion a year under the Federal False Claims Act since January 2009, compared to an average of about $1.4 billion per year from 1986, when the law was amended through 2008. It was initially enacted during the Civil War, in part to dissuade unscrupulous businessmen from selling diseased horses to the Union Army. Both the state and the federal laws allow citizens to sue on behalf of the government, and both provide the initial plaintiffs with a percentage of funds which are eventually recovered. They are known as whistleblower laws because the plaintiffs are frequently employees of the companies being sued. A plaintiff's identity isn't usually disclosed in a case that the state or federal government decides to take over. The law also requires a losing defendant to reimburse the government for three times the amount of the overbilling. While relatively few such lawsuits go through to the conclusion of a trial, that arithmetic weighs heavily for a plaintiff considering whether to sue and later when a defendant begins to consider a settlement. The North Carolina Department of Justice has taken over as plaintiff in 158 suits under state law that were pending at the end of 2011. That number was up from 86 pending in December of 2010, and department officials said it has since grown even further. Jackson Moore, who represents defense and other contractors as an attorney with Smith Anderson in Raleigh, says he's seen significant growth in the state and federal government investigations under the respective statutes in the last couple of years. You have a combination of increased federal oversight, and then you have the state, Moore says. Both of those combined increase the risk for companies who do business with the state and federal governments. The new state law has been used especially frequently to combat Medicaid fraud. Kelly says that situation is somewhat unique to North Carolina, whose Medicaid investigation unit has recently built up substantial expertise. Its bigger impact will be an expanded definition of false claim from primarily Medicaid fraud, Kelly said. Both the state and federal laws cover not only international fraud, but also negligence and overbilling, and in providing a wide range of false information. In one false claims case filed in late August in the Eastern District Court of North Carolina, the federal government alleges that a mortgage company misrepresented its eligibility to certify loans for federal insurance. As a plaintiff in a civil lawsuit, the government can win if the preponderance of the evidence shows that a contractor probably overbilled. That contrasts with the higher beyond a reasonable doubt standard used in criminal trials. The lower burden of proof can influence a company's decision to settle a false claims case. Companies that settle claims for payment ought to be on their toes every day, says Thomas Walker, a U.S. attorney for the Eastern District. It's one of our most powerful weapons to fight Medicare fraud. The federal government brought six false claim lawsuits in the district in the first 8 months of 2012, more than any full year in the last 5 years. Attorneys say larger numbers of false claim lawsuits are brought in the District of Columbia and several other federal court districts, regardless of where the companies are located. The FCA is the greatest fear of any government contractor that is paying attention, says Josh Howard, who oversaw white-collar criminal prosecution under Walker's predecessor and later served as general counsel for RTI International, a RTP-based government contractor. Prosecutors used to get their swagger by locking people up, but now a U.S. attorney is equally likely to have a press conference and now announcing a billion-dollar false claim settlement. Our next article, Obama-Romney campaigns rolling big bucks for local television. A new FCC requirement is pulling back the curtain a bit to better reveal how television dollars are being spent on the presidential campaigns in the Triangle. Taking effect August 2nd, the new rule requires Fox, CBS, ABC, and NBC television affiliates in the top 50 Nielsen markets to make public the ad contracts they've signed for the presidential campaign commercials. So far, only contracts after that date have been uploaded. The older documents come later. Files uploaded to a Federal Communications Commission site by four area stations, WRAL, WTVD, Fox 50, and NBC 17, show that the two camps spend a combined $832,470 for airtime between July 30th and early September, $478,975 for former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate, and $353,595 for President Barack Obama. For Obama, an additional $772,885 has been committed to be spent through the election. The Romney campaign, apparently in a pay-as-you-go mode, hasn't tipped its hand as to how much it intends to spend here in the latter part of September and the key month of October, at least according to documents on file with the FCC. Among the stations, WARL leads the way with payments and/or commitments. Obama, $577,035, and Romney, $212,440. All the figures are gross numbers and do not include commissions deducted by media agencies. A portion of the Romney money came in from the Republican National Committee, not directly from the campaign. Polling data for the state to date indicates the race will be a squeaker for North Carolina's 15 electoral votes. The latest reading by Raleigh-based public policy polling as of September 10th had Obama leading Romney in the state 49-48%. Jonathan Kapler, who tracks politics for the Raleigh-based North Carolina Free Enterprise Foundation, says, at the very least, the imperfect glimpse into campaign spending offered by the initial FCE document shows that both campaigns believe the state will maintain its up-for-grabs status right through the November 6th vote. The major media markets of Charlotte, the Triad, and the Triangle cover roughly 75% of North Carolina voters. Outside of those markets will fall places like Greenville and Wilmington, which have a heavy Democratic registration, but whose politics tend to conservative, which should therefore attract GOP campaign cash. Back in 2008, Obama won the state with 49.7% of the vote, taking Mecklenburg, Forsyth, Guilford, and all of the Triangle, and a block of counties in the state's northeast quadrant. Why at this point the Romney campaign, unlike the Obama organization, isn't reserving airtime through October remains an intriguing question. Some of their money didn't become available until after the convention. That may explain part of it, Kapler says, or they could be taking a different approach. Mark Mullaney, a campaign spending expert with the Washington, D.C.-based Open Secrets Organization, says campaigns generally book airtime in advance and pay the obligation off as the airtimes roll by. What surprises me is that a campaign would book times all the way through the election, he adds. That schedule might have to change if things tighten up in a state. According to the documents filed by WRAL with the FCC, the Obama campaign will run 123 spots between October 29th and election eve of November 5th at a gross cost of $54,015. Media agency placement deductions take the figure down to $45,912. The most expensive buys are a trio of 30-second spots between 4 p.m. and 7 p.m. during the National Football League broadcast on November 4th. At $2,000 each, the total cab came to $6,000. The next article is entitled, Some Profs Not Happy with the Science Grant Rule Changes. From Chapel Hill, changes in how a section of the National Science Foundation review grants has riled some faculty who say the procedures will slow progress in science. The NSF's Directorate for Biological Science Awards grants for research in molecular cellular biosciences, environmental biology, and similar fields. Due to a sharp increase in funding requests and a decline in funding, the leadership of the Directorate put more restrictions on the number of grants for which researchers may apply. Case in point, a subset of the Directorate for Biological Sciences has seen a 43% increase in unsolicited proposal in the past decade, while awards have decreased by 11 percentage points to 17%. The proposal workload across the foundation has increased dramatically over the past decade. Joanne Roskowski, assistant director of the NSF Directorate for Biological Sciences, wrote in a Dear Colleague letter explaining the changes. Clearly, this is a burden on the program directors and the administration staff at NSF, as well as on the community who, in addition to submitting proposals, are also called upon to serve as ad hoc and panel reviewers. Under the new regulations, the directorate will reduce the grant cycles from 2 to 1 and limit the number of proposals a lead researcher may submit to 2. Critics say this will hurt junior faculty particularly as they try to launch their research careers and will discourage collaboration, a growing trend that has sped up advances in the scientific fields. A group of more than 550 ecologists and environmental biologists wrote an open letter to express their disappointment with the changes. The letter was co-authored by Sarah E. Harvey, a professor in the Department of Ecology at the University of Minnesota, and argues the new process slows the pace of science, in part, because it creates an exceedingly long time between the time when ideas are first proposed and when funding becomes available. At UNC Chapel Hill, Barbara Entwistle, the university's vice chancellor for research, says she does not believe the new rules were meant to hamper any research or to hurt junior faculty directly. "I think this is a classic example of unintended consequences," she said. "It's completely understandable that NSF would want to make these changes. Their staffs are overloaded." She shares many of the concerns of other faculty, however, and says she hopes all parties can find a middle ground. Because of the focus of the UNC School of Medicine and the university in general on health, UNC Chapel Hill receives its largest portion of federal funding from the National Institutes of Health, a division of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Of the $545 million in federal funding the university received last year, 70% came from NIH and 6% from the NSF. Still, Entwistle calls those grants a very important source of funds because they target basic science. Across the University of North Carolina system, the NSF is second only to the NIH in terms of total grant funding. From 2008 to 2011, the NSF awarded grants totaling $431 million to UNC universities. The foundation has a $7.3 billion annual budget. Are annual pay raises finally coming back? Our next article. Annual pay raises are beginning to rebound somewhat after falling during the recession, but salary experts say a full rebound may take a while. Prior to the recession, the average salary increases were in the high 3% range in the triangle, according to data collected annually by CAI, a human resource management firm in Raleigh. In 2012, the average base pay increase is in the air 2.5% range, just up slightly from 2011. It seems to be pretty straightforward and obvious that the numbers are continuing to come back to the 3% number, says Molly Hageman, CAI Director of Human Resources Services. "I think it is fair to say that this has become the new normally accepted number." There are some other bright spots in the trend. For one, the 2012 increase of 2.5% is averaged with all the companies that reported no salary increases. In 2009, 48% of companies said they did not increase pay at all, and that figure dropped to 20% in 2012, which is obviously a positive, Hagerman says. Excluding companies that gave a zero increase, workers in the triangle saw about 3% increase in base pay this year. "The salary increases this year make sense," to David Rode, managing partner to Vaco Raleigh, an executive search firm. "Right after the recession, workers understood that they were going to be asked to do more work, but not receive a pay raise for it. Now, 3 and 4 years later, the expectation is to be rewarded for that work. And I think companies recognize that," says Rode, "and I think that employers who don't do that are making a mistake." Rode disagrees that smaller pay increases will become normal. He says the war for talent will return, and maybe sooner than others expect. Looking at the overall economy, however, the pay raise figures don't square with the unemployment rate, which stubbornly remains around 9%. Those who kept a job through the recession are likely going to keep it because they have proven themselves, says John Challenger, CEO of global outplacement firm Challenger, Gray & Christmas, which is based in Chicago. Those who are looking, however, can find it very difficult, largely because the talent pool is strong, but the job opportunities are few. Employers are very demanding, Challenger says. They are really looking to find high performers. Using a phrase that has become nearly ubiquitous among job seekers, Rhodes says, "You have to make finding a job your job." That might take 6 months nowadays as opposed to 6 weeks, but those who dedicate themselves to finding a job are succeeding. From the opinion section, franchising sector's jobs contribution. For aspiring entrepreneurs, the current economy is daunting. Unemployment is high, growth is low, and there is pervading sense of pessimism about the chances that things will turn around anytime soon. But there is one growth area in the economy, franchising, and I believe that it could be the key to a sustained and durable economic recovery. The longer-term growth prospects for franchising are also positive. To understand the appeal of franchising, one needs to look no farther than a business that I helped to build into a national success that's headquartered right here in North Carolina. Waumanaki Car Care Centers is now an international powerhouse with over 900 service centers. It always wasn't that way. It had to start with one store and grow. And grow it has. From one store and one product line to more than 50 million vehicle services with multiple product offerings, Meineke has exemplified the kind of potential that our nation's free enterprise system and the franchise business model possesses. Franchising has provided the foundation for local job creators to pursue and live the American dream. There are 825,000 franchise establishments supporting nearly 18 million workers in the American economy. And franchising will play an important and increasingly prominent role in our nation's economy and economic recovery. The industry is poised to grow by nearly 150,000 jobs and 12,000 establishments in 2012, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty for prospective and existing franchisees. Franchising does not decrease the amount of entrepreneurial engineering, hard work, or smart execution that any new enterprise requires, but it does offer structure, support, and a modicum of certainty amidst the enormous risk. When a newly minted franchisee builds a successful business, not only does he or she create good jobs, but their success benefits more than a franchisor. The entire community reaps the gain of quality products, services, and convenient location. In North Carolina alone, more than 26,000 different franchise establishments have helped create over 832,000 jobs and generated nearly $81 billion in economic output. The value that franchising creates for North Carolina and the nation extends much further than just jobs created. Franchises are often owned and operated by local community leaders who care about providing good service to their friends and neighbors. While so much talk these days about supporting small businesses and empowering entrepreneurs, more attention needs to be paid to what these local job creators are saying. Franchisees are the small businesses hidden among us. They operate on the fault line where government policy meets the private economy, and franchising offers the viewpoint from both ends of the spectrum, large companies and small businesses. As I join fellow members of the International Franchise Association in Washington to urge Congress to pursue pro-growth policy and common-sense tax reform, it is my sincere hope that one message in particular is heard loud and clear. Franchising equals jobs. This was written by Kenneth Walker, who is the former chairman of the International Franchise Association and the retired chairman and CEO of Driven Brands Incorporated, the parent company of Meineke Car Care Centers, Mako Franchising, Econo Lube and Tune, Aero Colors, and Drive and Style, and Total.net. Our next article. For competitive edge, hire a soldier. When the greatest generation returned from the battlefields of Europe and the Pacific at the end of World War II, they accomplished a feat nearly as remarkable as freeing the world from tyranny and oppression. They returned home to work on farms, in plants, and factories. They built massive industries and Main Street businesses and remade American economy into the largest, most successful in world's history. The greatest generation displayed remarkable courage and valor and continued to provide uncommon leadership, creativity, and teamwork, talents as important in commerce as they were in battle. Indeed, while their successes can be attributed to many things, it can most certainly be credited in part to the training, values, and skills developed in service with the United States military. Today, a new generation of leaders and teammates is preparing to come home after more than a decade of service to their nation, not only in Afghanistan, but Iraq, but also in more than 80 nations across the globe and right here at home. As the United States Army adjusts to post-conflict posture, that means many of those who today wear our uniform will be seeking new challenges and new opportunities. That's a potential boon for American business and industry. Like those before them, this next greatest generation exhibits remarkable values, training, and skills developed and honed in the service with the Army. Many of those skills are quantifiable. In fact, Congress recently passed and the President signed into law the Veteran Skills to Jobs Act. Among its provisions, it allows military service to count toward training or certification required for federal licenses in areas such as aviation, aerospace, and communications. But other skills developed in the Army are no less tangible and equally valuable to any business or industry. Hiring a soldier means that you're taking on someone who has already made education, physical fitness, high achievement, and a service a priority in their life. Everyone in today's Army is a volunteer, many of whom joined or re-enlisted during a time of war. They know what it means to commit to a venture larger than themselves. Fundamentally, the Army develops leaders. Early in his or her career, a soldier is often a squad leader in charge of a 9-person team. At the entry-level officer rank of second lieutenant, a soldier may be in charge of as many as 40 others and millions of dollars worth of equipment. Regardless of age or rank, the Army provides our men and women with the confidence, skills, and values to lead them when asked to do so. Depending on their military occupational specialty, soldiers have spent years developing additional experience as teachers, trainers, diplomats, police officers, engineers, nurses, mechanics, construction workers, and truck drivers, to name just a few. They've taught Afghan farmers how to improve efficiency and modernize their crop growing. The airlifts they conducted each day were greater than the number of shuttles flown between LaGuardia and Reagan National Airports. They drive more miles in a single day than any parcel carrier. In short, the experiences of today's soldiers are as challenging and diverse as in any workforce. But there's more. According to CareerBuilder.com, the qualities most sought after by employers include teamwork, creative problem-solving, multitasking, enthusiasm, and initiative. The American soldier has those qualities in abundance. Consider the great opportunities in hiring a soldier. You can start by visiting the Heroes 2 Hired website at www.h2h.jobs or learn more by contacting Joining Forces at www.whitehouse.gov/joiningforces and the Commerce Department's Office of Business Liaison at www.commerce.gov/officesecretary/officebusinessliaison. We'll now look at Washington briefs. Boehner not confident. House Speaker John Boehner, Republican Ohio, says he's not at all confident that a deal will be reached to avoid the fiscal cliff. The fiscal cliff is a combination of tax increases and steep cuts in federal spending that will go into effect at the end of this year if Congress fails to act. Many economists predict the economy will fall back into recession if Congress fails to avoid the fiscal cliff. The spending cuts, $1.2 trillion over 10 years, half coming from the defense budget, were created by last summer's deal to raise the federal government's debt ceiling. The across-the-board cuts, known as sequestration, were supposed to be so onerous that it would compel Congress to come up with a deficit reduction alternative. Average family premiums up. The average premium for family coverage through employer-sponsored health plans rose by 4% this year to $15,745, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. That increase is lower than the double-digit increases that were once common for employers, but it's still well above the inflation rate. Small business indicators up. A monthly index of small business indicators jumped 1.7 points in August to 92.9, reversing 2 months of declines. But the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index remained at recessionary levels, and only 4% of National Federation of Independent Business members think now is a good time to expand. The good news is the survey is that a net 10% of small business owners plan to hire additional workers, an increase of 5 percentage points from July. That's the best number for hiring plans since February of 2008. That was before the financial crisis hit. SBA offers free tool. Want to know how you're doing compared with other businesses in your industry? The Small Business Administration is offering a free tool called Size Up that will let you do just that, as well as identify potential customers. The competitive research analysis tool uses data collected from private and public sources and has been licensed by SBA for 1 year from GIS Planning, Incorporated. From the Clean and Greens Awards, a winner, Alternative Fuels Project, Waste Industry. Recently, Waste Industries launched its compressed natural gas fleet and filling station in Durham. The fleet is the largest fleet of refuse trucks running cleaner with CNG in North Carolina. The fleet, consisting of 20 vehicles, is the result of a year-long project in which Dove Waste Industries invested $8 million in developing and installing technology to build a CNG station on the grounds of its Durham Waste Services site. The project consisted of three main phases, including the CNG filling station, shop upgrades, and addition of 20 new vehicles. A CNG truck costs approximately $35,000 to $40,000 more per unit than a standard garbage truck. The implementation of the CNG fleet in Durham will reduce Waste Energy's carbon footprint, lowering carbon monoxide emissions by 77%, nitrogen oxide emissions by approximately 87%, and particulate matter emissions by 95%, greenhouse gases by 20%. Have sustainable efforts produce financial benefits? Waste Industries anticipates the CNG investment will operate for 6 years before experiencing a return. Well, that's about it for this week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. I've been filling in this week. Your regular reader will be back next week. Till then, goodbye. Thank you.